11 days ago on the Day of Atonement, can you believe it? 11 days since the Day of Atonement, we're all sitting there starving. We began our discussion on the two demises of Satan and his demons. Two demises. So just as a reminder for those of you who were with us or tuned in on the Day of Atonement, and to bring up to date those who were not with us on the Day of Atonement, I'll give you a quick summary, a quick overview of what we covered back then. We were working our way through Revelation chapter 12, and we can turn over there right now, please. Revelation chapter 12. And we're going to be going into that. And we started comparing the activities, okay, on the one hand, the activities of Satan and his demons in the last days of this 6,000-year age of man, as is pictured by the Day of Atonement, comparing those activities with the activities of Satan and his demons after they are released from the bottomless pit in the last days of the millennium. And that time is pictured by this day of the day of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, this is the feast and we're all rejoicing, and it's unpleasant for us to some extent to consider these disagreeable prophecies during our 7 days of rejoicing, of positive messages, of joyous messages. But that Gog and Magog period at the end of the millennium and its counterpart at the end of our own 6,000-year age, they are very real parts of what is going to happen. They're very real. And God put them, includes them in these 7 days, on the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles. So, and for that reason alone, it would be very unwise of us to overlook them. And of course, Satan would love us to overlook them, and certainly would love God to overlook them. But we need to focus on them today. Now, we finished in verse 11 with the prophecy of Satan and his demons being cast out of heaven and cast down to the earth, which, as we'll see, was great news for those living in heaven, but terrible news for the human beings living on earth. So let's quickly read through the first 11 verses of Revelation 12, and that'll bring us up to date to where we are. Okay, Revelation chapter 12 and verse 1. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. I won't go into all of the symbolism and the details of it. And the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought, and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation, and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Okay, and that's where we finished on the Day of Atonement. And so now let's pick it up and continue in verse 12. Verse 12, therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. So this casting out, and again now, so this is in the end times of our age now, of our 6,000 years. This casting out and casting down of the accuser of God's children will be a time of great rejoicing for the inhabitants of heaven, for God the Father, for Jesus, for the angels, for the archangels, for the 24 elders and the four living creatures. You think about it, that Satan's visits there must have been like a nagging pain to the heavenly host for such a long, long time. And then at last, these visits will be over. And that will be a time for great rejoicing in heaven. But heaven's gain is going to be earth's loss. That's when the trouble starts. Heaven's gain is earth's loss. And this will become a time, it says, of terrible woe for the inhabitants of earth and sea. Why will Satan's wrath be so very great at that time? Why? The main answer is because the first stage of his confinement will have begun. He's going to be like a caged mad dog, and so he'll be filled with indescribable wrath that we just can't even comprehend. Why? Because his sphere of operations now will have been greatly restricted to earth. God won't allow him to come back up to heaven to accuse us anymore. He'll be restricted to earth. But also because of his awareness at that time, when that happens, he knows that he's got a very short time left to do his dirty work. Very short time. There's the word woe in there. Whatever ideas you have ever had of the word woe, forget them, because the word woe, if you think that it's just merely a feeling of mild sadness or melancholy, forget that, because just, and we're not going to go into it now, but a brief Bible study on that word will reveal that when the prophets and when the apostles are inspired to write the word woe, that they were writing about times of terrible, terrible destruction. Let's move on to verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. So where we've got this insanely angry Satan now, when he realizes what's happened to him, that he will likely resolve then to go right after the woman. And so again, two aspects of the prophetic term, the symbolic term woman, that he'll go after some or all of the modern descendants of physical Israel, but more certainly and of a much higher priority for Satan, he's going to go after the spiritual Israel of God, the true church. It appears that Satan will by then realize that physical attacks on God's true and faithful children would be limited in their effectiveness. We read in verse 10 that they loved their lives not their lives unto death. And so, yeah, you know, you can You can come, you can kill us, you can drown us, you can do what you like. But he'll realize that he must attack them spiritually. So try to picture Satan now as he's cast out of heaven and he's cast down to earth, perhaps descending to earth with great speed and screaming to his demon followers, "If our time is short, let's make the most of it. Let's go get him." No, something like that. But then, when he thinks on this, perhaps we can imagine him slowing descent. Whoa! On second thoughts, let's use a more subtle approach. If we hit them too hard and too fast, they're going to put up their strongest defenses right away and we'll get nowhere. This is the mind of Satan. And I'm not sure exactly, you know, I'm paraphrasing here. And I'm not sure exactly what weapons Satan and his demons will use, but I am sure that those weapons will be spiritual ones. So what do we need to do? We need to put on and keep on our spiritual armor. The armor of God, the armor of light, the armor of righteousness. Not going to go in, you know, all of those scriptures. I'm not going to go into them today. They're all highly recommended and commanded by Jesus and by the Apostle Paul. That's another sermon. Verse 14. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time, and times, and half a time, from the face of the serpent. And this is where you know, the separation comes between physical Israel and spiritual Israel of the church. Because I can't really imagine, I think that this is where the church, spiritual Israel, is singled out. And God here promises to provide his children with a way of escape, which we call the place of safety. The place of safety. And when we think about the place of safety, we all have different ideas of what it's going to be like, and we don't really know. But God nowhere promises in the scriptures that every single member will simply waltz into the place of safety. Every single person who warms a seat in a Church of God congregation each Sabbath is not necessarily going to waltz into this place of safety. And although for his own, and I'm not being a downer here, but this is, you know, we're not to misinterpret the scriptures. We have to read it for what it says. Although for God's own good reason and purpose, some of his people, including the two witnesses, will not enter the place of safety. Two witnesses are going to be outside, as you know. But still, that does not mean that God's promises of protection for his children do not stand rock solid. They certainly do. He will give them, or us, you know, and these are the ones who are still alive. If we're not alive at that time, doesn't apply to us. He will give them a place of safety, and he will give them a means of getting there. And he calls it the wings of a great eagle. Now, I looked into the Greek words translated as fly and wings and eagle there, and they do seem to be literal. They do. And when we compare their use in this verse with other verses containing the same words, they certainly do seem to be literal. And back in the church in the 20th century and the early 21st century, some Church of God ministers and members as well speculated that God was going to provide huge jet airliners to transport his people to the place of safety. We had a member in Victoria, Lawrence Mason. Nancy, you'll remember Lawrence. He was a jumbo jet pilot. And we all thought that he was called to take us to the place of safety. But he died, so he wasn't. So, yeah, good old Lawrence. So we should remember that back, going way back to the time of Exodus, God also at that time miraculously bore his old covenant church in the wilderness, physical Israel, on eagle's wings out of Egypt to their place of safety in order to protect them from Satan and his hatred that was exposed through the human symbol of Pharaoh. We read about that in Exodus 19. You don't have to turn there. But as far as we know, they didn't go on jumbo jets. They walked all the way. And if Ten Commandments movie is to believe, they had some covered wagons as well. But with the help of God's miracles, there's no doubt about that. But they walked all the same, right? So we're not sure exactly what that flying is going to be like, but God is going to provide the means of transportation, because you're going to have to bring people to wherever he wants to be from all over the world. So it's going to be miraculous. It's going to be just as miraculous as the Exodus was, the first Exodus. Next question: where will the place of safety be? Where will it be? And Bible students must have been asking that same question from the very earliest years of the church when God inspired the Apostle John to write it. Will it be in some wilderness area? Yes, absolutely. It says in the wilderness. What does that mean? You know, California desert? We don't know. Will it be at Petra? Some people have hung on to that. Some people have really been dogmatic about Petra. And I think there's churches who are trying to build hotels there or something, you know, I don't know. Or could it be on Mount Sinai? Or would it be on some other location that might be very nice now, but by that day will have been turned into a wilderness, as much of the world is going to be, perhaps even Mount Zion? We've had hints, we've had speculations, we've had all kinds of ideas. But we must honestly admit these are some of the answers that we just don't have. We just don't know. What we do know is that even though the place of safety will be in a wilderness area, it's going to be a place of nourishment. Nourishment from Satan's face and from his attacks on God's children. Okay. So, and again, the majority of those attacks will probably be spiritual assaults. Just think about it, that this is Satan who is attacking the church here, not some mere human enemy. Without God's protective armor, even the mighty rock walls of Petra would be incapable of keeping out Satan's spirit, his attitudes, and his temptations. But wherever the place of safety might be, God will provide the most nourishing spiritual food there for his children. And as we've already seen, God's children will overcome Satan and his attacks, not by any physical fortress, not by any physical weaponry, but number one, by the blood of the Lamb, number two, by the word of his testimony, which is our testimony, brethren, and by the armor of God. So we believe that in that one verse there, verse 14, that this times and half a time indicate that God's people will be in a place of safety for 3.5 years, again being nourished by God. Some brethren believe that Jesus will actually be there in person I can't find any solid scriptural evidence of this idea. I don't believe that he's going to, return once and return once to sort us out in the place of safety and then come back again, go up and return for a third time in at the beginning of the last trump. So so again, the evidence is definitely against that. But one way or another, Jesus will be nourishing his brothers and sisters there spiritually. The Greek word translated nourished in verse 14 is trifo, Strong's 5142. And it's elsewhere translated feed, bring up, and it can mean support, breastfeed, fatten, nurture, and all spiritually, of course. During these 3.5 years, outside the place of safety area, wherever that might be, the Great Tribulation will be raging, the Great Tribulation. And the two witnesses will be out there, outside there as well. We believe that, they're going to be, at some point, they're going to be in Jerusalem. And they're going to be preaching God's truth to the end time world in the last of the last days of this age. Verse 15, and the serpent cast out, and that word is balo again, we looked at that in part 1, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. So here we have the spiritual woman, the bride of Christ, flying to a place of safety in the wilderness. And when that's happening, Satan, it says here, is going to violently bellow, is going to violently gush out a flood of water after her, going to try and knock her off her feet and carry her away. Possibility that it might refer to physical water partially, but certainly not only physical water. Satan knows once again that by merely killing God's people, by drowning them, he's only, in their consciousness, of course, all he'd be doing is expediting their passage into the kingdom of God. Okay, they're not going to go to heaven, but I mean, in their own consciousness, I mean. But again, please remember, never forget, Satan is not a human being. He's a spirit being, a powerful spirit being. And this water that he spews out of this, this water that spews out of spiritual Satan's spiritual mouth is going to be spiritual water. Remember what we were talking about the other day when we were talking about the Laodicean church, and we saw the church of God symbolically being in the safety of Jesus' mouth. Remember that? And we read about the spiritual healing properties of what comes out of Jesus' mouth. You remember that? So this appears to be another of Satan's counterfeits. There's something that's coming out of Satan's mouth. And we know that water is one symbol of spirit. So more than likely, Satan's water will be a great violent flood of his counterfeit religious spirit. Okay, and we could refer to that, if you want to think about it, as the unholy spirit. And he's going to spew that out of his mouth, I hate to use that word, sorry, in a final attempt to carry the bride of Christ away and to divert her from her goal. Verse 16 now, and the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. How will the earth help the woman in the church? I'm not 100% sure, don't have all the answers. It's a good point to meditate on. But it appears that Jesus will cause some kind of, I think of it as a cavern, to open up in order to divert Satan's flood, in order to prevent it from deluging his fleeing bride. But still, if the flood is spiritual, we may be sure that the cavern will also be spiritual. So it's hard to get our minds around exactly what that's going to be. Verse 17, and the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnants of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So again, Satan is going to be absolutely livid with anger because his spiritual flood is going to fail to destroy God's church. He's not going to be too happy about that. So he's going to turn up the heat even higher. You know, we say, hopefully the majority of the church is going to go into the place of safety, but now here we have a remnant. He's going to pour out his increased wrath. He's going to actually ramp it up even more on the remnant of the offspring, it says, of the woman or the church. Who are the people who are going to make up this remnant? I don't want to be in that remnant, and this is another question that God's people have probably been asking ever since the very earliest days after John put these words of this book of Revelation in writing. These people are described as those who keep God's commandments and who possess Jesus' testimony that we mentioned earlier. So we know that this remnant will certainly be made up of members of God's church. They're going to be commandment keepers. They're going to be people who possess Jesus' testimony. The English word remnant is translated from the Greek word loipoi. That's loipoy. And it means remaining ones, others, and residue. And the word offspring there, offspring is translated from the Greek word sperma, which means something sown, seed, issue, and this last one is really interesting, or a remnant as if kept over for planting. A remnant as if kept over for planting, and I found that really interesting. And again, not being dogmatic about what I'm going to say now, if we substitute these translations back into verse 17, we might understand it that Satan went to make war with the remnant of her remnant, the remnants of her remnants. And hopefully that would mean that the remnant would be very small in number. That might be just wishful thinking on my part, but anyway. But the two very intriguing ideas here for us to meditate are the idea of the remnants being the woman's seed, as it says, and not the woman herself. And I have a tough time getting my mind around that. They're definitely God's people. They keep the commandments of God. They have the testimony of Jesus Christ, but they're the woman's seed and not the woman herself. Think on that for a minute. And the other one is the possibility that the remnant might possibly be some seed that'll be kept over for planting. And in Matthew 3 and Luke 3, you don't have to turn there, Jesus said that the majority of his spiritual harvest will at the resurrection be gathered into his spiritual barns, okay? In other words, like kept for, on a physical basis, you know, kept in a barn or a silo for consumption, for turn into flour and bread, turn into consumption. Spiritually, changed into spirit beings at the first resurrection for use and work in the millennium, okay? Turn into a spirit being, come up in the first resurrection, meet Christ in the air. And this is a question. I'm not dogmatic on this at all, but might he perhaps keep this remnant as mortal seed. Okay, possibility. Now, this, you know, don't get up and walk out. It's just mortal seed for replanting amongst their fellow human beings in the first years of the millennium. Again, not dogmatic, just a thought, I don't know, but there's got to be a logical explanation for this. And another thought of this is that as this remnant is a seed or offspring of the woman, of the Church of God, is there a possibility there that these might be the literal, or some of the literal children of Church of God members? I don't know. Could it possibly be some of those who will be caught up in the end time falling away, but will repent and be converted at a later time? Again, I don't know. These are just things to speculate in. How many of our brothers and sisters have strayed away? You know, we heard about that in the sermonette. You know, will God, you know, allow them to come back at that time? I don't know for sure. Just a thought, just something to meditate on, to think about. One day we'll find out. But it appears, though, that for God's divine purpose, those who constitute this remnant will not be granted entry into the place of safety, but must continue until the time of the first resurrection and be exposed to Satan's final and most vicious attacks. Not very pleasant thought. But again, God's two faithful witnesses will not be in the place of safety. So we absolutely know that. So we know that, well, we can't say that they will be counted among that remnant. But because the two witnesses, we know they're going to be somebody very special. We have no idea who they are. But they're going to be specially chosen by God. But because they won't be in the place of safety, we should take care not to assume that only the brethren who are not allowed into the place of safety will be those harbouring Laodicean attitudes. You know what I'm saying? That if you've got a Laodicean attitude, then you'll be a punishment. You won't be allowed into the place of safety. It doesn't say that. And the logic of the two witnesses not going in there proves that. So, where am I up to? In fact, it might be the most faithful ones, those that God sees have the greatest strength and courage, that will be left outside the place of safety and exposed to Satan's final attacks. We don't know. Again. Okay. At the end of Revelation chapter 12, John pretty well cuts off this part of the prophecy that's dealing with the dragon's attack on the remnants of the woman in the church. We are not given all of the details, and who knows, maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe God has hidden the details from us because perhaps he knows that we couldn't handle them. So this dragon now, okay, is Satan. We know it's Satan. He's mentioned again in chapters 13 and 16. I'm not going to go into all of that. He will be the inspiration and the power behind the beast, the various beasts actually, and the false prophet. But when the dragon actually returns to center stage in chapter 20, it's only going to be to mention that his power and his influence will at that time be severely reduced. Will be severely reduced, severely, but temporarily. And that's where we're going to move over into the next section of the sermon here. Let's go over to chapter 20, Revelation chapter 20. And here we get some good news. Revelation chapter 20 and verses 1 to 3. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season. Okay, I'm going to come back to that. Satan, when he was a super archangel way back, his name was Halel, according to, in the Hebrew, his name was Halel. Not Lucifer, Halel. And he was one of three, we believe three, super archangels, and all three apparently had equal strength, from what we understand. There's a couple of scriptures that indicate a couple of times that the archangel Michael had a tough time, a major struggle, restricting certain of Satan's activities. Can you imagine that? Can you? It's hard to be able to understand these monumental forces that are at work there. So in order for an angel, as it says there in chapter 20, in order for an angel to bind and imprison Satan, Satan must be weakened. He's got to be weakened. And if so, how will Satan's power and influence be so drastically diminished, for an angel to be able to grab him, chain him up, and throw him into the bottomless pit? We've already read part of the solution back in chapter 12. Let's just go back again. We'll come back to Revelation 20, but let's go back to chapter 12 again and verse 10 and just reread this here, because it's got the answers here to this question. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Revelation 12 verse 10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him, that's us, backed up with Jesus' power. We are going to overcome Satan by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, our testimony, Jesus' testimony in us, and they loved not their lives unto the death. So, do we have this power now? On our own? No, we don't. But here's the second part of the solution and the antidote to Satan and his poison. Let's go over just one verse over in chapter 17. In verse 14, Revelation 17, verse 14, this is the second part of the solution and the antidote to Satan and his poison. Verse 14, these are human beings, these are human pawns and servants and worshippers of the dragon, shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him, and that's us brethren, are called and chosen and faithful. So again, the dragon's power and influence will be severely reduced. And again, let me repeat, say severely, but again temporarily. And that's so very important for us all to remember. And that's where my Day of Atonement sermon ends. And now we start the Feast of Tabernacles Day 7 sermon. So what happens next? What happens next? Exactly what we've been picturing for the first 6 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. We've been picturing the millennium. and that's great. So let's go back to chapter 20, Revelation chapter 20, and here's what it's going to be. Verse 4, Revelation chapter 20, verse 4, and I saw thrones, and they sat upon them. Brethren, we are promised that we're going to sit on thrones, believe it or not. We're going to be kings and priests. And judgment was given to them, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Verse 6. Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. We read it over and over every year at the feast. And this is the same 1,000 years that's mentioned in verses back in verses 2 and 3. So, during, you know, since Trish and I have been in the Church of God, the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles has often been given as symbolizing 1,000 years of the millennium. Some disagree with it, or some have different symbolisms, and that's fine. But I'm happy with this symbolism. I'm happy with the others too. If and when we use this symbolism, that we take the 1,000 years and we divide it by the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, and we come up with 142.857 years per feast day. Let's round it up to 143 years per feast day. So now, as we move into verse 7 of Revelation chapter 20, we're looking at what we're seeing here prophetically is the final period of the millennium. During that, you know, we can think of it as 143 years, but this is going to be more likely the very last years of the millennium, and maybe even the very last days of the millennium. I don't believe that this is going to happen in the last great day period, because I believe that is, once we get into the last great day period, that is totally set aside and holy for what we're going to learn about tomorrow, and that Satan will have no part at all in that. He's going to be gone by the beginning of that day. So, what happens next then? Again, at the very end of the millennium, still in chapter 20, verse 7, and when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. So, this is, it's almost unbelievable that this is going to happen. But after his release, Satan is going to have a surprisingly large amount of success when he goes up to tempt the remaining human beings who are still going to be living at that time during the final days of the millennium. And there's a good possibility there's going to be a lot of human beings by then. You know, there'll be a lot of being fruitful and multiplying during the millennium. And but we would like to believe, again, we'd like to believe that the number of these deceived human beings will just be a localized few. But brethren, that is not the case according to God's word. Satan, it says, is going to deceive the nations in the four quarters of the earth. It says the numbers of those deceived are going to be as the sand of the sea, and they're going to go up on the breadth of the earth. This is hard to believe, but this is in God's word, and this is a solid part of the symbolism of this day, of the seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles, whether we like it or not. It's in there and we have to face it. We may safely assume that as the years of the millennium go by, and especially as that final 143-year day progresses, that Jesus and his brothers and sisters are going to expend an increasing amount of extra warning efforts. You can imagine that, you know, 7 years to go, we know that Satan's going to be coming back. 6 years to go, we know that Satan's going to be coming back. Get ready, you know. So how could the people who've enjoyed such wonderful peace and prosperity under the perfect rulership of Jesus in the millennium, how could they be so easily fooled when Satan is released? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but we think about that possibly some humans who are living in the final years of the millennium, maybe to them that these stories about Satan and his demons, they might almost have become like mere ancient myths, you know, after all of those hundreds of years have gone by. It's like in our day to day, again, perhaps in the latter days of our age, the people of the world have no idea who is causing all these terrible events out there. You know, they can blame the Syrian leader Assad, they can blame Putin, they can blame any human being that they like, but they have no idea that Satan is causing all of these terrible things. And just shows you that how quickly we mortals do forget. And why should we be surprised? You know, think about atrociously evil men like Hitler and Stalin. They lived less than 70 years ago, and their names and their crimes have perhaps become mere myths to some of the young people of today. The generations that lived during those middle years of the 20th century, they had first-hand experience of the evils of these men, and they grow old and die, and those accounts are becoming forgotten or overlooked as myths by some young people. Anyway, most or all of the human beings who will be alive in the final years of the millennium, they will never have lived in a Satan-ruled world like we have. Never. And although they will have had many strong advance warnings, they will have had no direct first-hand experience with Satan's devious ways. Perhaps many of them will be lulled by the peace that will have reigned on earth for 1,000 years. And possibly, even likely, Satan will use his 1,000-year confinement to plan his final last-ditch strategy. Adolf Hitler was imprisoned between 1923 and 1924. And it appears that when he was in prison, he planned what he was going to do when he came out. And when he came out, he was the most wrathful and vicious and deceptive that he had ever been. Satan, you can imagine that Satan is going to be something like that, that for 1,000 years he's going to plan what he's going to do. Okay, now for some good news. And it's bittersweet news, especially for the human beings who are going to be caught up in this situation. But let's continue then in the second half of verse 9, still in Revelation 20. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. That's not good news. Here's the good news. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, or will be, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. That is going to be Satan's fate. you know, that's pretty well the same fate as he tried to foist on human beings. He tried to get people believing that, you know, if you know it, you'll go to hell and you'll be alive for eternity like that. He's the one who's going to be alive for eternity in the bottomless pit there. What will be the final fate of those many thousands or even millions, I don't know, who've been deceived? Will they be lost forever? I don't know. Will it be a case of, well, you know, you should have known better, you should have heeded all of those many warnings, or will they be given a chance to repent in the second resurrection? Again, I don't know. Thankfully, our perfect God is the perfect judge. But let's go back once again to what may well be the last days of this age. Even now, is Satan like a myth to any of us? We can't see him, it's invisible. But whether or not our day to day is actually the last days of man's 6,000 years, still, individually, our time on earth is very limited. So even if Christ is not going to return for another, 20, 30 years, you know, some of us are not going to be, around. So we all need to heed the warnings that are meant for our era. And we need to be constantly alert and wary. We need to be aware that the dragon is alive and well. And he's walking to and fro on earth. He's pacing up and down like an angry lion. And he's ready to pounce. And he's trying and he's tempting God's people. Let's go over to 1 Peter. Just one verse over here, please. 1 Peter chapter 5. Again, I hate to give Satan the time of the day, you know. I mean, we give him the mention on the Day of Atonement, but this, you know, if we forget about that end of the millennium, the Gog and Magog period, then we're only getting half of the story. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour." And as we've seen, when Satan has a success in tempting a person to sin, he hurries up to God's throne to register that accusation against us. Did you just see what Fred Bloggs just did? You know, please keep in mind that, you know, this is not some kind of story. This is the Word of God. And please keep in mind, Satan is a great and powerful angelic prince. Again, his name was Halel. He probably holds the same rank as the loyal archangels Michael and Gabriel. And for God's divine purpose, Satan has been temporarily allowed to remain the prince of this world. He is the prince of this world. He is allowed to be the God, small g, of this world now. And he already has the vast majority of its people firmly in his grip. He's not worried about them. It's you and me that he really is after. His accent in the last days of this age will likely be on tempting God's people over to his side by even now spewing out this flood of his unholy spirit on us. As we look at the increasingly troubled world events of today, most of God's people, and we've been asking these things for 40 or 50 years, have the events of Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 taken place? Has Satan been cast down to the earth yet? We look at the recent, and I'm not going to go into them, just mention them, the vicious wars and terrorist attacks, the famines, the increasingly bizarre weather conditions, they would suggest that he has been cast down, but we don't know for sure. Personally, I don't think so, because I think when he gets cast down, we're going to know about it. We're going to know. It's going to be so horrendous that we're really going to know about it. Okay, we can't be totally sure. What are we to do? God gives us the instructions. We must keep zealously and carefully watching and praying. Jesus tells us to do so over and over again. A load of scriptures here. I'm not going to read them. But you look up in you, if you have a concordance, look up the word watch. Look up the word watch. Like I say, I'm not going to read all of these through. You know what they are, and you can find them through what Jesus said, watch. What the Apostle Paul said, watch. What Peter said, watch. What the Apostle John said, watch. You know? So, as God and his family are going to increase their warnings to their people as they get closer to the last years of the millennium age, so I believe that God will be increasing his warnings to his begotten children now as we get closer to the end of this age. Keep those two parallels in mind. God is preparing true Christians for the kingdom of God, and as part of this preparation, we have a duty to be getting ready for the casting down to earth of Satan and his demons. Our Father and our elder brother love us and care for us, all of us, very much. And through their word, you know, our Father is shouting at us in love, you know. He's saying, stay awake. And if we're asleep or dozing, like one of those unwise virgins, if we're asleep or if we're dozing, he's telling us, wake up, he's shouting at us. Come on, you know, maybe he's giving us a slap up the back of the head, I don't know. We must heed their urgent warning so that we can be sure that we'll be counted worthy to be around to help those people resist Satan when he is released at the end of the millennium. We have a job to do. We're going to, you know, yeah, Jesus is going to be doing it. We're going to have a job to do. Maybe, you know, part of our job now is to prepare for that. Again, watch world conditions. Yeah, you know, watch. We have to be careful. Satan is devious. And we should take care to look behind the major headlines. I looked on CBC this morning, and there's so much pablum on there. So, you know, you look down and you say, you know, talking about some, I don't know, some film star had done something. It's rubbish, you know. But even with the world news, you know, since 9/11, perhaps, you know, we've been putting all of our watching time, if you will, into searching out the news of terrorist attacks and other Mideast strife. Not saying that that's not important. They might be significant. But if our attention is on the headlines alone, Satan can take advantage of our tunnel vision. We're looking at this, and over here something else is happening. It might be lower key, but it might be a more significant fulfillment of end time prophecy. And if we're not careful, it could slip by us unnoticed. So we have to be careful of that. Again, those people in the final days of the millennium, they're going to need to be preparing themselves for Satan's release in the same way we, in what might perhaps be the last years of this age, we need to be preparing ourselves for the casting down of Satan and his end time attacks. Please turn to 1 Corinthians in conclusion. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And verse 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And I can't think of a better verse to finish on. And this is where God has given us the final word on this and the admonition on this. In this time of increasing, it's going to get worse. In this time of increasing physical and, more importantly, spiritual danger, it is our great God who is able to give us the protection that we all need. And it is our great God and Jesus Christ who can give us the courage that we all need so very, very much. So, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 13, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong.